Today's show is a special one. I had the pleasure of anchoring a live stream of a Seder in the streets to stop arming Israel, which was held on the second night of Passover on Tuesday night. The demonstration was held in Brooklyn, one block away from the home of Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, just hours before the Senate approved a $95 billion foreign aid package that includes about $17 billion in arms and security funding to Israel. Hundreds of protesters were arrested. During the Seder, I was in a studio on Manhattan's Lower East Side providing commentary and interviewing special guests. Rabbi Brant Rosen, filmmaker Michael Moore, journalist Abby Martin, actor, playwright, and essayist Wallace Shawn, human rights and environmental lawyer Stephen Donziger, and actor and activist Susan Sarandon. And I was joined in studio by Fouad Dakhwar, a Palestinian-American musical theater writer and the creator of the great musical Fouad of Nazareth. Hello, everyone. You're listening to The Katie Helper Show, and I'm your host, Katie Helper. If you like the show, please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, and as always, remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. To support the show, visit patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow, where for just $1 a month, you can help make the show happen. And for $5 a month, you'll qualify for great bonus content, including alternative podcast feed and rarely seen clips that aired on our live shows. Live from New York, I'm Katie Helper of The Katie Helper Show with Jewish Voice for Peace. We are watching the Seder in the Streets action, hosted by JVP, Jay Fredj, and If Not Now. Tonight, as we are about to enter the 200th day of Israel's relentless onslaught of Gaza, we are going to upset the order of our Passover holiday, and we'll be both exploring some of the lessons of the Seder holiday, a story of exodus and liberation, and examining the lessons in the current context. Following the October 7th Hamas attacks for over 6 months, Israel has engaged in a brutal bombing campaign on the besieged territory of Gaza, illegally limited food aid, bombing hospitals and residential neighborhoods, widespread destruction of schools, refugee camps, and other civilian infrastructure. The official death toll of 34,000 is almost certainly an undercount. And of those, over 14,000 children have been killed, while many, many more have been maimed and traumatized. Amid this violence, Jews in the United States have not been silent. Hundreds with Jewish Voice for Peace and organizations such as If Not Now came out immediately to demand a ceasefire, shutting down major bridges and highways across the country, protesting across the country and at so many Biden campaign events that the president has been forced to hide from his constituency. Rabbis have descended on the Capitol. Alongside our Palestinian brothers and sisters and other allies for peace and justice, the battle to stop ethnic cleansing has been multiracial, multicultural, intergenerational, and is only growing. For some context, in addition to the regular $3.8 billion in military aid to Israel, the Biden administration has been approving arms sales and ferrying through additional huge military aid packages. Over $14 billion in November, another $26 billion was just approved by the House this week. Simultaneously, the U.S. government stripped funding for 1 year to the largest aid organization in Palestine, UNRWA, and vetoed multiple U.N. Security Council resolutions demanding an immediate ceasefire, only reducing it to an abstention, allowing it to pass late last month, and then declaring it non-binding, which is a lie. This week, the country was shook when Colombia President Baroness Shafik asked the New York City Police Department to arrest anti-war demonstrators encamped on the Columbia University lawn. New York Police Chief Don Chell disputed Shafik's description of the protesters as a clear and present danger, saying the police found the students peaceful and cooperative. Nonetheless, over 100 were arrested. Instead of quieting the demands, the protests have grown. Over 100, including faculty, were arrested Monday night at New York University, and the protests have spread to Yale, Harvard, the University of Michigan, and many more. These protests, virtually all with heavy Jewish presence, have been smeared as anti-Semitic. The New York Times decried virulent anti-Semitism at the Columbia protest, while protesters held a Pesach within the protest. And that accompanies the big action where Jewish activists and allies are protesting the genocidal assault on Gaza. They're getting arrested. They're blocking traffic. They held a Seder, and they are reclaiming Passover and presenting it in a way that is very appropriate for what we are experiencing right now or witnessing right now, because, of course, Passover is a celebration of liberation, and we cannot be free while other people are not free. And that is why Passover is such a perfect holiday for what we're seeing right now. Jews out there are saying not in our name. They're saying never again is now. They're saying that you cannot commit these crimes against Palestinians in the names of Jews. And as I've said many times, and I know a lot of other Jews feel this way, Israel does not make us safer. Israel puts us at risk. It doesn't make me feel safe seeing Israel commit heinous crimes against humanity with the Israeli flag, claiming that they're acting in the name of Jews. That's why I think it's so important for organizations like Jewish Voice for Peace to be out there saying that this does not represent us. And, you know, a big irony is that the claim that anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism is actually anti-Semitic in itself, because it conflates being Jewish with being a supporter of the state of Israel. And that, of course, is the dual loyalty trope, which is an anti-Semitic trope that we fight against. But you have places, governments like the Israeli government, you have places like AIPAC, you have the ADL, which are claiming that being Jewish means supporting the state of Israel. They're fine perpetuating this anti-Semitism because they are not about Jewish safety. They are about a political project which oppresses other people. I'm very excited to be here speaking to Fouad Dakar, who is a musical theater composer, writer, and comedian, and he's the creator of a great show called Fouad of Nazareth. So welcome.
Thank you, Katie. Thank you for having me.
Of course.
Maybe you forgot to mention I'm Palestinian.
Oh, I didn't want to reduce you.
Right.
Yes, please. I wanted to invite you to reduce yourself. Yeah.
I'm the token of the night. You pulled me off the screen.
I've never met him before. I was just looking for a Palestinian. I saw him in a keffiyeh, dragged him in, and then found out he's actually Jewish and an ally. No, you are a Palestinian, indeed a Palestinian. I did see your show. Tell us what it's like for you these days. I mean, seeing all these protests, these encampments, where have you been going to? What protests have you been going to? How have them been making you feel?
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in Morningside Heights right by Columbia University. So I've been actually dropping by maybe 3 times a day outside the encampment. I guess mainstream media would call me one of the outside agitators that are coming by. No, but it's been really promising to see a movement that is well organized, that the organizers are saying, let's not distract from the issue at hand, which is genocide in Gaza. And that's promising to see that there is support for that. As much as, you know, all the noise around it will try to distract from that. I think the distraction tactics are becoming more obvious than ever.
Right. I mean, it's so funny. You hear people say how it's not a safe space for Jewish students. Like, well, if it's not safe, why were they celebrating Shabbat, having a Shabbat dinner?
Right.
Why are they having seders? Are they self-loathing? Well, we do get that a lot, you know, self-loathing Jews
right.
like me. If you're believing in Palestinian rights, you obviously hate yourself.
Yeah. It's the ADL's like playbook, right?
Yes.
We see Jonathan Greenblatt now saying that, first of all, the students should be arrested, I think, by the National Guard is his new line. But we saw earlier this year that the ADL was marking Jewish-led protests, like tonight's Seder in the streets, as anti-Semitic events.
Right.
So it completely delegitimizes the term, too,
exactly.
because real anti-Semitism is around. So
it totally trivializes actual anti-Semitism.
Exactly.
Yeah, I agree, yeah.
Which isn't happening on the encampments, as far as I've seen. And the organizers have made statements condemning any, you know, anything that's happened.
Yeah. And you've also seen tweets. I mean, people are, obviously, they're going to be agent provocateurs who are not with the allies and Students for Justice in Palestine or Jewish Voice for Peace. So that's also something we have to, of course, be vigilant against. And speaking of the ADL, actually, Jonathan Greenblatt said we have analysts in their groups. Mm. So we know that they have infiltrators. Yeah,
absolutely.
It sounds like we're on a conspiracy theory show. We're just stating the truth. Yeah. But what is it like today being Palestinian American? Is it different from what it was like before? Mm. Do you feel like there's more awareness? There's more criticism of Israel than there used to be?
Oh, I mean, absolutely. The numbers show that. I think I like to describe it as like a twilight zone where, you know, 5-6 years ago, even people weren't as outspoken. There are people that were actively Zionist that are now posting about Gaza. And that's a really promising thing. The petty side of me is like, wait, you're talking about it now too? Yeah. Come on. No, but
you're like, I'm an OG. Exactly. I'm an OG critic of Israel. Yeah. Welcome to the club.
You got to you steal that too? Yeah. The land and
exactly.
Now the movement.
Right. Yeah. They're colonizing your politics.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, I'm used to it by now, but the main point is it's been really exciting to see the movement growing. The numbers show again that we are changing in the right direction, especially among young people.
Yeah.
It's exciting.
And tell us about your show and how it tackles these issues.
Yeah, actually, I think I should pitch right now. That's the best thing to do. No, I'm writing a show that is based on my experience, right, as a Palestinian Christian at that, and also a citizen of Israel. So I sort of break all the boundaries, but it uses dark comedy and rock music to bring the Palestinian narrative, one version of it, to the theater.
And it's one of the top five Palestinian rock narrative shows I've ever seen.
Right, and I'm the other four.
The other four, yeah. And tell us about some of the ways that you've had to push back against censorship as an outspoken activist on the issue of Palestine and Gaza.
Absolutely. I mean, the thing I'd start with, I don't even know how many opportunities I've missed out on because I'm very vocal about Palestine, because my work is explicitly about Palestinians and our experiences. I am on Canary Mission, which is, thank you. I've been, I'm not fresh off the boat.
It's on it though. You make me feel, I know. No. I'm such an underachiever. Yeah.
Come on, Katie.
And Canary Mission, for those of you who don't know, it's this terrible website that Zionists, corporation runs that basically tries to smear people and make them unemployable.
Absolutely.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. And they target explicitly usually university students, which like we're seeing now is a
so
common
gross.
Attempt to find people who are early in their careers. So, it's out there whenever you type in my name. That's one of the first thing that comes up. The second thing I'll say is there have been, I had an opportunity recently, sometime in December, that was a big platform that I was going to share my work on. And I needed to use that platform to speak out about Gaza. I felt that I couldn't be telling a story about Palestinians and not mention what's happening to us right now with genocide. So I made a statement, and if people can't tell already, this, but the way I sort of, my method of revolution is through comedy. It lets me get away with a lot more of what I want to say, and also connects with people in a different way and breaks down barriers. Maybe not physical barriers quite yet. We're working on
it.
Yeah. but the playbill situation, there was a
Playbill is the
it's a big musical theater
publication.
Absolutely. Very known for in Broadway world, and I guess at the end of the day we actually won. We got past the censorship attempt in which I made a statement that we luckily had some, I guess, allies internally potentially. Again, I think it helped that I used comedy, that I used music. And you can watch it, it's up. But now obviously the numbers that I said about the genocide are outdated. This was months ago. So, hopefully we're seeing more opportunities, especially I'm thinking of theater. We've seen attempts at censoring Palestinian and Palestinian related works. My Name is Rachel Corey was a show at New York Theater Workshop that got canceled, before getting canceled was cool.
Right.
Palestinians were doing it. So luckily we saw the Vagrant Trilogy open at the Public Theater recently. That was 2 years ago. After the Siege of Freedom Theater show was canceled. I'm rambling. I'm going on.
This is all very important. And tell us about your experience in Palestine.
I'm a Palestinian citizen of Israel. So I used to visit every summer. That's what the latest musical is about.
Which is very good. Fuad of Nazareth, which I highly recommend.
And the Katie Halper show is very good as a viewer.
That's why I brought him on. I paid him a lot of money.
It's wonderful. Yeah. You have some really great guests on there. But I guess my experience there is a strange one because I've been Americanized in many ways. And obviously just revisiting Palestine when it's been so heavily colonized and also just seeing, I think the time I was there that I wrote about was during the Gaza offensive in 2014, where we saw, not the numbers we're seeing now, but it's a reminder that this didn't all start in October, so.
How's your Arabic?
It was my first language. I'm not 100%
Got it, yeah.
Yeah. And you want to learn? You want to, should we get some lessons?
Michael Moore, he is the Academy Award winning documentary filmmaker. He's also the host of the Rumble podcast. Michael, thank you so much for joining.
Thank you, Katie, for having me on. And thank you for all the good work you do. And thank you for giving me the harshest laugh I've had this year so far with what you and your partner there put together, a remix. It's of Nothing's Gonna Stop Us Now.
Right.
The genocide remix.
Yes. Yes.
You know, during a time like this, well, you know, it's kind of like, it's the kind of laughter of, if you don't laugh, you're going to cry.
Right.
Because of the utter sad truth of it all. But it's exactly at moments like this that we need people like you, because I do think that humor, satire, is a way to keep the engine of our hearts going. So thank you for that.
Thanks. And that was a cover of the song Nothing's Gonna Stop Us Now that was covered by Bibi Netanyahu and Joseph Biden. It was a duet that Daniel Mate and I, beautiful duet, yeah.
It was an ironclad duet.
Yeah.
And it was just, if people listening or watching us have not seen it, will your producer put up a link?
Sure. Yeah, we'll throw that in, yeah. Yeah.
Incredible. Yeah. Nothing since Tony Orlando and Dawn is measured up to this. So thank you.
And
so
I did not bring Michael on to talk about this, just so you know. But Michael, thanks so much. It's been great talking to you. See you next time. Just kidding. Yeah. But thank you. That's so nice to hear from you. Wanted to ask you about your first time, because you've actually been to Palestine and Israel. Can you tell us about that and what your thoughts were when you made that visit?
First time I was to Israel, Palestine, and Gaza was in 1985, a long time ago. I had already been, I had my own newspaper in Flint, Michigan, the Flint Voice. I'd been around the world. I'd been to the third world a lot. I'd seen a lot. I'd never seen anything like this, and especially Gaza. And you know how it is sometimes in your life, maybe when you've seen something that you literally now cannot unsee. And the images and what I experienced there back there in the early to mid 1980s, the images are still in my head. I honestly couldn't believe it. And then the next time I went was about a month into the first Intifada. So this would have been early 1988. When it was kids with stones being fired upon by Israeli soldiers with either bullets or a lot of rubber bullets. I mean, a rubber bullet just like went like right. It kind of grazed right past my nose. And I was, wow, I am being shot at by the Israeli army. And I had to process that for a minute and then get myself into a doorstop. You know, the rectangle thing that holds the door, but the door is back there. So I'm trying to stand back so I don't get hit by one of these bullets. And let's just say I mostly fit into the doorstop. But it was, it's pretty crazy. And, but I was so affected by it that, I immediately wrote about it. I'd taken a lot of pictures. Roger Mee came out my first film in 89. So this is before that. I'm just living in Flint. I'm living in southeastern Michigan, the largest population of Arab Americans, Muslim Americans. And in a city like Flint, that not a large city, maybe at that time, 150,000 people, but with four synagogues.
Wow.
Uh, the large Jewish population in Flint, mostly because the auto workers and the auto workers union, which was founded in Flint with the sit-down strike against General Motors in the 1930s, a large number of Jewish Americans from Brooklyn in the early 30s decided to come to Flint and Detroit to help the auto workers form a union. They were all communists, and they trained people like, you know, my grandfather, my uncle, all of how eventually they were going to take over the factories with a big sit-down strike. And they tried it first in 1932, and they failed, and General Motors crushed them, and a lot of them were beaten. But they didn't go back to Brooklyn. They stayed, and they said, we'll do this. We'll figure it. Now we know what we did wrong. We'll figure it out again. And 4 years later, essentially on New Year's Eve, they decided to catch General Motors by surprise. They'd organized all, you know, all the people, are thousands, including my family members. And they succeeded, and they took over the factories. They locked the doors. They wouldn't let GM back in. GM turned off the heat. You know, it's the winter time. No heat, no water, no food, 44 days. They found various ways to sneak things in, but it was a fight. They brought out the National Guard. There were machine guns surrounding the factory. And only until Franklin Roosevelt essentially stepped in and told General Motors, you are not to shoot a single auto worker. And in fact, he then had the governor of Michigan told him, I want you to turn those machine guns away from the workers and and aim them at the Flint police and the Pinkertons, the private army for General Motors. Put the guns on them if they try to hurt any auto workers. And it basically ended the strike, and they got the first contract and all that. But anyway, I'm just saying all that because I, on this day, on the second night of Passover, that people from Flint, the lifers, people that all know this story, that we wouldn't have what we had if it weren't for the Jews of Brooklyn that came to Flint and devoted their lives. And then after they won the contract, after our dads and uncles and moms, my grandmother worked in the AC spark plug factory, after they got a living wage and health care eventually and everything else, these Jewish union organizers essentially stayed in Flint. They didn't go back to Brooklyn ever. Right. They stayed there. They raised their families. Their families raised their families. And so we had this large Jewish population while we were growing up.
And now we have Jews in Brooklyn, the ones, different Jews in Brooklyn, who are right now on the streets. Also, of course, we have people who have been arrested at universities, and you have people actually saying that they need to call in the National Guard.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, this is so out of control, what the police are doing, and not just there. I just got my sister from California, just sent me some pictures from Cal State Humboldt, which is way up in Northern California, where nobody watching this will ever go. But like the students there, it's happening all over the country. And right away now, I guess everybody got the memo, send in the police, arrest the students. Oh, no, wait, what law are they breaking? They're students here. This is where they live. It's their home. Oh, suspend them. So they're not students anymore. And then 5 minutes later, arrest them for trespassing. They're all doing this all over the country. And I only can hope, and this is what is so great about the current generation, because what they're doing, they have messed with the wrong generation. And this is going to just build tomorrow, this week, next week. And they're all, and they, you know, and I say, I'm not trying to take credit as a parent of this one person of this younger generation, but I do think that a lot of us raised our kids right to stand up for what they believe in, to love all people. No bigotry, no anti-Semitism, no misogyny, no homophobia. All these kids now, they're really in the second generation of kids being raised this way, to where they wouldn't really, most of them wouldn't know how to be homophobic or anti-Semitic, because it's just not in their soul. It's not in their being. And the fact that they're being called anti-Semitic, and so many of the Jewish students are participating in these protests, that and it's kind of like, my daughter, she said to me, but the Palestinians are Semites.
Right. That's true.
So what is being anti-Semitic? I said, well, that's a good question. I guess you can still be against Jeffrey Epstein.
Yes, I think that's safe. Yes, he is. Yeah. No, I hear you. Then I'm a self-loathing Jew, if that's true, because I also oppose Jeffrey Epstein. Hot take. You heard it here first. Well, Michael, we have to go back to... No, it's okay. Wanted to wish you a happy birthday.
Oh, thank you.
Happy birthday. And we have to go back to the protest, but any final words that you have to say about Palestine, about the protests on the streets, about what we're seeing right now?
Well, again, having been there very early on, I've lived with this and carried this with me my whole life, a whole adult life, of seeing the treatment of people and there. And I beg everybody, regardless, Jewish, Palestinian, Christian, atheist, you know, whatever you are, we are human beings. And we have to, this is madness, absolute madness. And it's not just yet Netanyahu. I'm tired of keeping saying Netanyahu because I'm trying to be protective of, you can't blame a whole people for this, but this is literally madness now. The mass slaughter of innocent people. And if we are silent, any of us right now, we are contributors to this. We are enablers of it. That sign I saw one of the kids holding, silence is violence. This is not the moment to be silent. If you're a student, get involved, join these demonstrations. If you're a high school student, start one at your high school. You have rights. Do not pay attention to the police. All rights are being violated right now. New York City is famous for it, doing this, what they're doing at Columbia. You remember during the Republican convention, how they mass arrested anybody protesting Bush back in 2004? The city had to pay tens of millions of dollars to the protesters for housing them in that pier for those days. They're wrong. You're right. Keep doing what you're doing. And let's stop this killing. Pull the plug on Israel. Pull the plug. No armaments, no military aid. Do what Jose Andres did starting on October 7th. If you want to do something like what he did for Israel, 1.7 million meals he provided to Israelis who lost their homes around Gaza, who are now exiting from near Lebanon, and then his people are murdered by the IDF. No more. And to my friends who aren't going to like what I'm saying, I'll say to you what somebody said to me the other day, because I've been posting this stuff. If you will speak out against this killing, you're doing more to save the people of Israel than Netanyahu or all these other crazies. This will save the people more than anything else. Nobody should be killed. Nobody should die. And the younger generations will not tolerate an Israeli state that acts in a fascist form. And eventually, nobody will tolerate a theocracy. We should all be living in democracies. Everybody, equal human rights for all. So thank you, Katie, for everything that you do and this incredible work that you've always done. I'm a huge, huge admirer. And please, everybody, no more silence.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. And really appreciate all that you're doing and all that you've done. And also for being an early critic before it was cool to be a critic and an early ally of Palestinians. So thank you so much, Michael.
Thank you so much. Take care.
You too. Welcome to the show, Rabbi Brant Rosen of the Tzedek Chicago Synagogue. You're also a co-founder of the JVP Rabbinical Council. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
So, happy Passover.
You as well, Katie.
Can you tell people about Passover, the significance of the holiday, and why it makes sense to be doing a Seder in the streets right now for Gaza?
So Passover or Pesach is one of the central Jewish holidays. It comes from the Torah. It comes from the Bible. It is a commemoration of the mythic story of the Israelites' exodus from biblical Egypt. And it has been observed by Jews for centuries. It's a week-long festival that involves abstaining from bread products and leavened products, but the signature moment of the holiday is a Seder, or sometimes two Seders, that take place on the first 2 days of Passover, where Jews have folks over to their homes, sit around the table, and have a meal while they tell the story of the Exodus. But not only tell the story, there is a whole pedagogy to the Seder, in which questions are asked and the meaning of liberation in general is interrogated. And that is really the central, I think, moment of the festival, is this idea of not only telling the story, but plumbing the meaning of it for our own day. And that's meant different things for Jews throughout the centuries. But in the current moment, I think, I would even say over the last several decades, there is increasingly a trend toward universalizing the story of the Exodus. And in other words, not only focusing on Jewish liberation per se, but understanding that this mythic story of liberation is something that has been cherished by many different peoples throughout history. And in fact, is something that's being experienced in real time. In the late 60s, Arthur Wasko, Rabbi Arthur Wasko, started something that came to be known as the Freedom Seder during the Vietnam War, as a way of understanding the Exodus story and liberation in that context. And right now, we're witnessing a remarkable in-the-streets version of these Seders happening on college campuses throughout the country, to understand this notion of liberation vis-a-vis Palestinian liberation, and specifically as a way of lifting up a cry against the Israel's genocide against the Palestinian people in Gaza.
And how does your Jewish identity, your Jewish faith, your Jewish values relate to the struggle against genocide?
Well, you know, just to go back to the Exodus story, this is the central sacred story of the Jewish people, which is that God is a God of liberation and stands with the oppressed and demands that we call out the oppressor, the pharaohs in every generation. So that is baked into being a Jew on a very, very deep level from our spiritual tradition point of view. You know, in terms of historical memory, to be a Jew after the Holocaust means that genocide, that attempted genocide against our people, is something that is also baked into what it means to be Jewish. The near destruction of European Jewry during World War II. And so, you know, when we read this story and we read about Pharaoh viewing the Israelites as a demographic threat and enacting state violence against them to enslave them, it's impossible to understand the story, I believe, in the current moment without understanding that part of what it means to be Jewish from a historical point of view is to absolutely take a stand against genocide in every manifestation, not only against Jews, but against all peoples.
Can you talk a bit about Tikkun Olam, what that principle is and where it comes from?
Sure. So Tikkun Olam literally means repairing the world. And it is it has come in contemporary times to be experienced as another very central Jewish spiritual imperative. It originally comes from concepts in medieval Jewish mysticism that viewed the world as a broken place, that there was this kind of cosmic snafu that occurred during the creation of the world, and there are sparks of divinity that have been scattered about the universe, and that the sacred task of the Jew is to reunite these sparks, bring them back together to engage in repair in a very cosmic sense. But that has come to be understood on a socio-political level as well, I would say, that when we engage in acts of justice, when we do the kinds of things we've been talking about, when we call out the oppressor, when we seek to dismantle state violence and transform it into equity for all, that is engaging in tikkun olam, in repair. And so many contemporary Jews understand tikkun olam both in terms of service and direct action, but also in terms of fundamentally restructuring society itself to be a more equitable and just place for all.
And what are your thoughts on the protests that we're seeing at universities, not at universities, the discourse around anti-Semitism and anti-Semitic speech? What are your thoughts on this?
I can't remember a Passover when I was more deeply moved, I have to tell you. It's breathtaking. You know, what we are seeing is grassroots spiritual political action in its purest form. You know, we are seeing this very cynical weaponization of the claim of anti-Semitism on college campuses as a way to gain political power, but also to draw attention away from the very real genocide that is occurring against the Palestinian people. You know, the claim of Jewish students being unsafe because other students are protesting genocide has just been so deeply hypocritical and galling to observe. And so to see Jewish students and allies coming together and celebrating Passover openly in quads on college campuses to show, first of all, that there's nothing unsafe about being a Jew in public, but also to use their spiritual tradition as an act of solidarity is just, to me, that is the purest form of Passover there is. And it is a political statement that it is perfectly safe to be a Jew. It may make some Jews uncomfortable to call for a free Palestine, but this is, I think, the best possible response to the very cynical political ploys that are being taken to weaponize anti-Semitism on campuses and throughout the country.
Thank you so much, Rabbi. Really appreciated talking to you.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me, Katie.
Have a great Seder. Back to the Seder in the Streets broadcast. I'm Katie Halper from The Katie Halper Show, and I'm here in studio with Fuad Dakwar. We are talking about these protests that we're seeing right now on the streets. We have people out on the streets. They're getting arrested. They're engaging in civil disobedience. Their arrests. What are your thoughts on the arrests that we're seeing, not just tonight, but in general? What do you think about the harsh tactics, the draconian measures that are being implemented against protesters?
I think Michael Moore said it best of, like, this is a long history with the NYPD. It's nothing new that we've seen, especially against Palestinian protesters of any kind or any sort of Palestine-affiliated groups. Right. The case of Columbia and NYU, NYU targeting literally its faculty with arrest, shows, again, where the real priorities lie for these institutions.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it seems very coincidental that right as Israel's crimes, I mean, crime after crime are being discovered, and they've just, you know, uncovered literally like a mass grave where people were killed at the hospital, and you found corpses that are literally handcuffed and wearing scrubs. I mean, it's so awful. The world should be talking about that. And instead, we're talking about alleged anti-Semitism on campus. And instead, we are criminalizing people who are expressing their First Amendment rights to protest and their guaranteed constitutional rights to gather and protest and to speak out. And it's really unfortunate that we have to even spend any time kind of pushing back on that. But we do. We have to do both things at the same time, right? We have to talk about Israel's crimes against humanity. We have to talk about the fact that we know that there was no evidence against the UNRWA workers, mm-hmm. even though Israel used that as an excuse to get UNRWA defunded. I mean, this is shameful that other countries had the decency, after committing the crime of defunding UNRWA, other governments at least had the decency to refund UNRWA. The United States won't even do that. So they are, you know, doing Israel's bidding on so many levels. We are arming Israel. We are also complicit in defunding an aid organization that Israel lied about.
And that will last for at least a year and right. maybe beyond that. They're not even giving promises about that.
Yeah, I mean, it's like every time you think that you couldn't get more shocked about what Israel will do and what the United States will do to cover Israel, they find another low.
Yeah, and it's so blatant. And I think you said it best that this is a clear deflection from the issues. Right. We started to see the American mainstream media caring about when it was aid workers that happened to be Westerners, right? Being killed in the case of the World Central Kitchen. And then finally, we were seeing some coverage of the world, like war crimes in Gaza. Right. And then suddenly, you know, we saw the situation with Iran. And now we're covering these student protests, which something, that I mentioned, I love that these organizers of the encampments are saying, if you're going to cover our protest, cover what we're actually protesting, which is the situation in Gaza. They are constantly bringing it back to the issue at hand, not these, you know, made up controversies about a chant.
Yeah.
Or that people are reading too much into or finding their own situation.
Yeah, and that's a solidarity. Even, you know, these universities are saying it's not about solidarity with Columbia students. That's important, but really that's one level. The real important thing is that this isn't solidarity with Palestinians, and this is about Gaza. And it is about, of course, academic freedom and freedom of speech and the right to protest. But what we're really trying to bring everyone's focus back to is what is happening on Gaza. And it's just ironic when you hear people talking about student safety and they're talking about what it's like to be a Jewish person on campus. And there are two things that I would say to that. One is, well, a lot of Jewish students are actually the ones protesting, right? They're saying not our name. They're saying their Jewish voice for peace. They are, you know, support justice, Students for Justice in Palestine. But the other thing is, if you care about scholastic freedom or scholastic safety, you should be pretty upset that there are no universities left in Gaza.
Absolutely. And that they're targeted specifically. Like, it's not, it's a purposeful attempt by Israel,
who has
targeted also
damage.
Cultural centers, right? And intellectuals. This is a clear part of a bigger plan there.
Yes. And part of genocide. And also something else that we've seen them do, of course, is target journalists. And I mean, they'll do terrible things when journalists are killed in the line of reporting. Like, there's that terrible story about that journalist who literally was was forced to bleed out over the course of hours because they wouldn't let medics reach him. And they even shot a medic trying to reach him. But in addition to that, they have the targeting of journalists in their homes with their families. Mm-hmm. You know,
yeah,
this is not the Where's Daddy program, the AI program that we've heard about. But it is, I mean, the silver lining, I guess, and of this is seeing that younger people are no longer buying into this propaganda, this, you know, benign talking points that people try to use to justify genocide, like Israel has the right to defend itself, or Israel has the right to exist, all these things that sound nice but are actually being used to justify slaughter. People are seeing through that more in ways that they didn't before.
Absolutely. I mean, the cat's out of the bag, the toothpaste can't be put in the tube. All those whatever phrases are so true when it comes to young people. And that gives me hope, you know, in a really hopeless time, a silver lining about what the future could look like if these, you know, thinkers and people are the ones leading the charge in the future for human rights for Palestinians and all of us.
Yeah, I also think it's so great to see how interfaith these things are. Mm-hmm. And it's so great to see, you know, you have Muslim students praying together, Jewish students praying together, students of different faiths celebrating together, doing each other's dances, each other's cultural activities. And it's also great because I think it's important for the world to see that being Jewish does not mean supporting Israel. And I think it also makes it easier for people to criticize Israel without being accused of anti-Semitism. Like, obviously, some Jews will still be called self-loathing Jews. And I also don't want to center Jews at anyone else's expense. But let's be realistic. Like, the more Jews are critical of Israel, the harder it is to pretend that criticizing Israel is anti-Semitic.
Right. And that's part of a broader, I think, necessity to make sure that this isn't, it's clear to people that it's not a religious issue. That's another common talking point, that this is just, you know, some religious issue that goes back thousands and thousands of years, when really it's very clear the starting point being the Nakba in 1948 and the expulsion of over 700,000 Palestinians from their homes and the you know, Zionism as a concept of being built on Jewish supremacy in a land. So I like to usually, I'm wearing a cross right now. I don't usually do it. I don't know if this will mess up my mic right now. But I've been wearing it recently just to show, like, there are, first of all, Palestinian Christians, and that my, you know, family's values as Christians are in Humanity for All, and that there is a like you said, a multicultural and multi-religious movement here that we have, and that it's not, again, some religious issue that can never be solved.
Right, that myth about, oh, it's just Muslims. First of all, it totally erases the non-Muslim Palestinians, right? Christian Palestinians. But it's also a myth, this, oh, Muslims and Jews, they just can't get along. They're never going to get along. It's a clash of cultures, clash of civilizations, which also erases a very rich history of coexistence.
But Katie, why didn't you bring on the Muslim to the podcast? Why'd you bring me
on? It's true. You're right. Yeah.
We should call it here. Or pull a different one off the street.
Hello and welcome back to the Seder in the Streets broadcast. I'm Katie Halper and I'm here with Fouad Dakhwar, who is a Palestinian-American comedian and musical theater writer. And we are so excited to be joined, not in studio, but virtually, by the wonderful Abby Martin. She is the host of The Empire Files. She is the director and producer of the amazing documentary Gaza Fights for Freedom and the forthcoming documentary Earth's Greatest Enemy. Abby, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. Happy Passover to everyone there.
Thank you. Happy Pesach to you as well. Wanted to ask you, what are your thoughts about what we're seeing right now? We have people out on the streets getting arrested here. We have people who've been arrested at universities across the country. What are your thoughts on the way the police are responding, the way the university administrations are responding? What does this mean?
Yeah, I mean, as an Occupy head, someone who was in the middle of the encampment in Oakland, I have never been more excited about a movement that is swelling right now. I think it's incredible, inspiring, and I'm so optimistic about where this is going and the fact that it's just catching on like wildfire. I mean, the reaction is just absolutely ludicrous. The fact that you have the NYPD doing what they do best. I just saw on the live stream arresting dozens and dozens of Jewish people who are standing against genocide, saying not in our name. It is like living in a parallel universe, like an alternate reality. I mean, I on one hand, I'm watching the peaceful encampments. I'm watching Jewish students alongside Arab students, alongside non-affiliated students. And they're all together, standing together, respecting each other. I mean, this is what's really, you know, changed, I think, this time around, Katie, is that, like you were saying before, I mean, we're no longer on the defense as anti-racists and as anti-bigots and people who care deeply about the plight of Jewish people and fighting against anti-Semitism. We're no longer on the defense saying criticizing Israel is not anti-Semitic and here's why. So now the genocide defenders are on the defense, and that will always be cemented now. Now Israel is an apartheid state committing genocide, and those people have to be shamed and apologize for their position. So I think it's beautiful, but I mean, just think about how insane this is. The fact that students, hundreds of students all across the nation are being arrested for standing up to the repression of pro-Palestine speech. For the last couple of years, Katie, pro-Palestine speech has been the most policed speech on college campuses, even though we've heard Milo Yiannopoulos and Candace Owens and all these people love to talk about free speech on college campuses and how offensive it is to be heckled. No, when we're talking about criminalizing speech and policing speech, pro-Palestine speech is the most criminalized speech in the country. And like I said, the alternate reality of the president of the United States to the president of these universities talking about the outrageous anti-Semitism on campus, what are they talking about? What the hell are these people talking about? They have to construct an alternate narrative again. I mean, it's just like everything that we've seen in the last 6 months. Don't believe your lying eyes. Don't believe your lying eyes. Just take the word of our politicians and media pundits telling us, no, this is about anti-Semitism. This is not about protesting genocide. And it's honestly cartoonish, Katie. It is cartoonish. These people aren't protesting. It would be bad enough if they were protesting the Iraq War or something that the U.S. government was doing and being repressed just the same. They're protesting a foreign government committing genocide sponsored by the U.S., and the foreign government is threatening American citizens. They're threatening American citizens, saying you will never get a job. Right. Your degrees will be meaningless. The audacity of the Israeli government to be taking to social media, actually threatening the livelihoods of students. But this isn't the first time. Look at what they've done with BDS laws across the country, and it's time to stand up and say no more, and I am here for it.
Well, speaking of BDS laws, can you tell us about your own experience? You actually sued the state of Georgia.
I did. And sadly, so many more states have installed these BDS laws, which basically says that if you're a state contractor, whether it be a substitute teacher or a construction worker in the state, any of these states, I mean, it's basically like 90% of the states in the country now, you have to sign a contract pledging fealty to Israel if you want to receive funds from the state. So I received such a contract in Georgia. I was appalled and I was taken aback. And, you know, as someone who'd covered these laws, of course, I refused to comply and sign this contract. And the entire conference that I was supposed to speak at Georgia for fell apart. And I sued over this law. It's an egregious violation of the First Amendment. The right to boycott was enshrined during the Montgomery bus boycotts. This is a political speech issue. And so the judge, Judge Mark Cohen, actually ruled in my favor initially. And then an Israeli consulate official, an actual foreign lobbyist, sat in the Georgia State House and advocated to change the law and render my case moot. So it was fascinating to see a judge do the right thing and then an Israeli government official come and actually lobby to change the law. And everyone just said, okay, this is about anti-Semitism. We'll do it. I mean, the lobbying campaign to conflate Judaism and Zionism and to make every critique of Israel about anti-Semitism has been appalling. And it's worked for so long, but it's not going to work anymore. And the fact that these BDS laws were already put into place is that they knew the tide of justice was coming and mounting. They knew the inevitability of a movement, the masses refusing to participate in what is going on. So they saw that, they saw the writing on the wall a long time ago, Katie, and that's why these BDS laws exist. And I'm positive if more people take them to court, that we will get the Supreme Court to do the right thing. I don't know what the Trump-appointed judge is there, but you know, one can only hope.
Yeah. Well, I have more questions, but before that, Fouad, do you have any?
On that point, Abby, because you succeeded in at first, right, fighting back against these through a court system, and then they changed the rules on you, I'm curious about your broader philosophy about fighting through the system. You know, we hear about fighting in the system. We hear about electoral politics a lot. I'm curious, what's your overall philosophy? Is it worth still fighting these fights, even when we know they will change the rules on us?
100%. I mean, I always say voting is just pulling a lever every 2 to 4 years. It's, the fight is in the streets. It's with our bodies every single day, all day. It's about political education. It's using every tool in our arsenal. And one tool is litigation. And that's why you have the right wing organizing for decades to try to take over these institutions and circumvent, you know, all the gains that progressives have won, or not just circumvent them, override them and undermine them. And so I think that, yeah, doing this in the courts is one tool that we can do. Obviously, voting is one tool. I would never advocate voting for Genocide Joe. I think that voting third party and punishing Joe Biden for what he's done, even though Trump would be doing the same thing. I think, you know, they've given us no other political avenues in the system, in this corporate duopoly. But I think, you know, real change, of course, historically comes from the masses in the streets. And that is why I am living for what is going on right now. I am so, so happy and inspired by these students in the face of this political repression, in the face of being gaslit by all these people and knowing that they're risking arrest every day. They're risking actually their livelihoods because of what's happening. Because of the leadership of these universities. It's disgusting. They're all corporate stooges, right? I mean, so the resilience of the students, I think, is where the movement will lead us, and the divestment campaigns, because that's what Israel's terrified of. Divestment, divestment, divestment. We are winning. And that's what's going to make apartheid fall.
And last question for you, Abby. You did this amazing documentary, Gaza Fights for Freedom, which I highly recommend for everyone to watch. What are you hearing from the people you're in contact with in Gaza about what they're experiencing?
My God, I mean, everyone has a horror story, obviously. I mean, you know, no one is unaffected by what's going on. The three people that were primarily centered in the movie, Ahmed Abu Artema, who was the lead organizer of the Great March of Return, when Palestinians peacefully resisted in 2018 and 2019 with bared chests, holding flags, and they were relentlessly and methodically killed by Israeli snipers, perched behind sand dunes, picking them off like it was target practice. That man, that beautiful poet, his house was targeted in a strike. His 10-year-old son was murdered. And the last I talked to him, he was sitting in the hospital with second degree burns alongside his other two children. So I have no idea where Ahmed is right now. And I pray that he is safe and that he survives. My other friend, the main producer on the ground, Kareem, he just escaped because I actually did a GoFundMe where I gave, you know, we were able to raise $70,000, and both of the families that worked on the film were able to flee finally. So after 6 weeks of waiting, they escaped through the Rafah border. But Kareem was displaced twice. His wife was 6 months pregnant. She wasn't able to drink water, Katie.
Oh my God.
And then Maza, the lead videographer, his brother was killed. Two of his brothers were killed. He had to wait 6 weeks to retrieve his brother's body in their collapsed house that his father built with his own hands, because Israeli snipers would kill anyone who tried to retrieve the body and do a proper burial. So it's been really hard checking in with my friends every day. And it's honestly just gotten to such an excruciating point of, what is it going to take? What is it going to take? What is the breaking point for the world? And I mean, this is what we need to do. We need to escalate the tactics, because for 6 months straight, we've been out in the streets. We've been agitating our political representatives. And these tactics that are being escalated, whether it's Code Pink with the actual aid flotilla, yeah, or the students starting these encampments in Occupy 2.0, this is what's necessary. This is what's necessary. And this will change history.
Thank you, Abby, so much for your words of inspiration and for all that you do. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much, you guys. Great live stream. It was an honor to be here.
Welcome back to the Seder in the Streets broadcast. We are so excited to be talking to the very special guest, the actor, essayist, playwright, Wallace Shawn, and also activist. So welcome, Wallace Shawn.
Great to be here.
Thank you so much for joining. Why is this issue important to you? I know that you're active with Jewish Voice for Peace. So what makes you interested in this issue of Palestine?
Well, I mean, I suppose it's the same as a lot of the people in the street. I suppose, I believe really that almost everybody has an innate sense of human decency, right and wrong, internationally. I do believe that. Of course, customs are different, but I think that shooting at ambulances and starving people, torturing people, trapping people in a place they can't escape from and massacring them, killing children, these are things that I think are upsetting to most humans when they hear about them.
Right.
Now, in Israel itself, obviously, they are experiencing a kind of insanity and they're suppressing that naturally human sense of decency. And God knows what the result of that ultimately will be for them, but that's what they're doing. So, I mean, but I also happen to know a little bit about it. I don't think you have to know about it to know that killing the innocent is evil. You don't have to know much, just as in the Vietnam period, for the most powerful country in the world to be bombing peasants was, people knew that was wrong, even if they didn't know the history.
What are your thoughts on the protests that we're seeing now, both in Brooklyn with Jewish Voice for Peace, but also the protests that are taking place at universities?
Well, I think that when I read my New York Times, they describe these protests as pro-Palestinian. Now, some of the people in the protests know a lot about the history and care deeply about the Palestinian people. But these are not really demonstrations in favor of the Palestinian people. They're demonstrations against horrifying sadism and cruelty. You know, the desire for a ceasefire for most of the people at the demonstration is about human suffering, not so much about the liberation of the Palestinian people, which may be the primary thought in the mind of some people. Pro-Palestinian, as the New York Times describes these demonstrations every day, implies that there's like a sports match and you're either on the side of the Palestinians or you're on the side of the Israelis. That's not the right way to think about it. And it also, pro-Palestinian also implies that the people in the demonstration are supporters of Hamas and believe enthusiastically in terrorism and in what the fighters of Hamas did on October the 7th in Israel, which I am promising you most of the people in the demonstrations don't support.
And how does it compare to the days of the student protests about Vietnam?
Well, you see, I'm not a great expert on it because I, at that time, was a moderate liberal. I only became more of a, let's say, a leftist when I was 40 or 41, 42, around then. I mean, but even I knew that the Vietnam War was wrong. And I think that at that time, after the demonstrations in the 60s had gone on for a while and gone into the 70s, people drew very broad conclusions from them about our entire system and capitalism and our American way of life. And some people have said that this is the moral crisis of our time, Gaza, and it could be that people will draw very deep lessons from this. I mean, I want to, one of the other aspects of the demonstrations that I would like to express is that I think the Israelis are trying to convince people that all Jews are Israel supporters. And some of us would like to point out to the people of the world that there are some extremely benign, decent Jews who despise what is happening, who loathe what is happening. And you know, it's horrible, really, to think that the consequence of Hitler's crimes was the creation of this misbegotten state, really, which many left-wing Jews warned against, by the way. The creation of a state which is now the most hated country in the world. Thank you, Netanyahu. This is a terrible, terrible thing. And unfortunately, so many of the people in Israel seem to support what their government is doing. And, you know, I hope to God that there will be change over there, and that the reputation of Jews in general will not be harmed. I mean, I think all the talk about anti-Semitism, it's very hard to, I don't really believe that there's a lot of anti-Semitism on campus of Columbia University. to me, anti-Semitism is about despising a race of people. I don't think so. I don't think they've come up with many examples of actually bad things that have happened to Jews, although the students, Jewish students, particularly Zionists, may feel hated, you know, but that's not anti-Semitism. Let's hope that anti-Semitism doesn't develop. Anti-Semitism in Europe was a hatred of people who had not harmed anybody. They burned people at the stake in the 14th century because they thought they'd poisoned the wells, and they hadn't poisoned the wells. They thought that they were killing babies, and they weren't killing babies. They were innocent. Now, the Israelis are really doing something bad.
Yeah.
So let's hope that anti-Semitism is not a result of that.
Well, I'm curious about your shift from moderate politics to leftist politics at 40, 41. Was your perspective on Palestine part of that shift at the same time? We see a lot of progressive accept Palestine. Was that, did that happen at the same time for you? How
it didn't really happen quite at the same time. I mean, I think I read more about the United States in Latin America, for example, had a huge effect on me. And then my girlfriend had always been a leftist. I think for many years, in a subtle way, worked on me. One of the things, she gave me a book of Chomsky.
Oh, nice.
I immediately loved that book and immediately loved him. And of course, he wrote a great deal on the subject of Israel-Palestine, and I read what he wrote. I read what other people wrote. I loved the book, The Iron Wall by Avi Flame, an Israeli historian. That was a wonderful book that affected me. And then I met some incredible people from Jewish Voice for Peace, who kind of recruited me to Jewish Voice for Peace, largely because they were so smart. I felt more comfortable associating with them than I had previously felt with other groups. I mean, I'm a difficult kind of person because I don't like to sign a petition where I don't really agree with all of it.
Right.
Although I've learned that you have to sometimes in political life. But I felt very comfortable with those people.
Wow. Well, I'm glad that you felt comfortable with them and that they were able to recruit you, because you're such an important voice on this issue. So congrats to you and to Jewish Voice for Peace. And thank you so much. We're going to go back to the protests, but we want to thank you for joining, and definitely we'll check in with you at another point, because you have so many great, interesting things to say on this and so many other things. So Wallace Shawn, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. Thank you so much.
Excited to be speaking to attorney and climate activist Stephen Donziger. Welcome, Stephen.
Thank you, Katie. Really happy to be with you.
So tell us why the issue of Palestine is an important one to you.
Oh, man. I mean, you know, this is probably the human rights issue of our generation. And it's important to me just as a human rights person, attorney, advocate, but it's also important to me personally because I grew up Jewish in the United States of America. And I grew up, you know, being kind of educated, or I should say miseducated, with a lot of mythology about the state of Israel. So, you know, since October 7th, it's been, you know, quite the journey for me personally. But most importantly, I'm utterly outraged as a human rights person and just as a human being at what the state of Israel is doing to the Palestinian people, both since October 7th and, of course, from decades prior. So, you know, this is the issue. And if you believe in human rights, if you believe in justice, this issue must be dealt with, addressed, spoken out about. And I've tried to do that, you know, as much as I can since October 7th in my own small way.
Tell us about the encampments you've visited and the protests you've been to and what you've seen.
I have spoken there and lectured there at the law school twice in the last couple of years, just about climate stuff and my own journey as a human rights lawyer fighting Chevron. I went up there a few days ago. The campus was completely locked down. It's militarized. The New York City police are surrounding the campus on the outside. Many of them are in riot gear. What people need to know is the New York City police is not like a typical police department. It is like probably the largest and most sophisticated city police department in the United States. It has a military wing. It does, you know, surveillance of Muslims and others that it considers threats to the power structure. It's almost like a kind of a combination of a CIA and a traditional police force. And the, you know, as we know, the president of Colombia called in the NYPD to try to squelch a legitimate, peaceful, nonviolent protest about these human rights atrocities being committed by the Netanyahu government and by the state of Israel, which I find to be not only a violation of academic freedom, but really outrageous. You know, it's also personal because I live right near Colombia. I live 10 blocks away. And I've lived in this neighborhood for, I don't know, 20 years now. And my son and I, multiple times, go to Columbia. We go to, you know, basketball games there. We, you know, we walk through the campus. We admire it. My son's like, God, you know, when he's little, he's like, I want to go here. And it feels like an extreme violation on a lot of levels, including of the neighborhood. But more importantly, I just want to salute the students out there for their solidarity with the people of Gaza. I mean, this ultimately is not about my feelings or about the neighborhood. It's ultimately about the fact that, you know, thousands and thousands of people, most of them women and children, are being slaughtered, you know, with U.S. weapons financed by U.S. tax dollars. And the Biden administration is doing this with our money. And if we don't speak out, this kind of thing will happen again and again and again. And ultimately, you know, the students at Columbia, many of whom have been arrested, students elsewhere at Yale, NYU, many other universities, they are leading the way in this country right now on this issue. It's not the politicians. It's not Congress. It's not the mayor of New York who's tried to defend the president of Columbia. You know, it is the students. And I've seen this throughout history. I felt it as a student when I engaged in protests in college and grad school. Students almost always are the cutting edge of the spear in terms of moving a society forward. And I'm just incredibly proud the students for engaging in this kind of peaceful protest activity. It's a damn outrage that the Board of Trustees at Columbia, the president of Columbia, has violated academic freedom and tried to shut it down, acting like it's some sort of threat to the order of the university. It's an expression of the essence of the university. And the order, the disorder, any threat is created by the reaction to that, by calling in the police, riot police, to militarize Columbia's campus. It's an outrage, but it is forcing the issue forward. And it is spreading around the country. And I think that we're at a pivotal moment on this issue right now because of the leadership of these students. And I'm really happy to say that that's a silver lining to this.
And you said that you were miseducated on this issue growing up as a Jewish person. Did you have an aha moment that made you reconsider how you see the issue of Palestine, or was it more gradual?
Well, I've been dealing with so much in my own kind of journey as a lawyer battling Chevron, and that I just never thought I could really take on this issue over the years. And once October 7th came, you know, the next day, my son, who's a senior in high school, is like, Dad, you got to post about this. I'm like, well, I don't know. He goes, no, Dad, you got to post about this. Everybody's talking about it. And my first post, which I did on October 8th, was about human rights reports from like Amnesty, from Human Rights Watch, from Israeli human rights groups, that Israeli has an apartheid system of governance. And so, you know, the mythology that Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East, it's just a total complete lie. It's the opposite. It's actually a state that's structured based on discriminatory laws against people who are not Jewish. And as a Jew, and again, as a human rights person, like, I don't want this being done in my name. It's not for my benefit as a Jew. It actually is antithetical to everything I believe, including my own Jewish values that I treasure. So, you know, I would say starting October 8th, when I sort of started to get my head around this, I really became deep into it. And I also started to notice, like, all the myths, like, the myth we grew up with. I don't know, I believe you're Jewish, Katie, but, like, you know that myth that says, you know, a people without a land and a land without a people. Total lie, you know. And by the way, I bought this book. I just wanted to hold it up by Rashid Khalidi, who's a Columbia professor of all things, called The 100 Years War in Palestine. I read it. I read every page of this book, underlined every page, couldn't get enough of it. And I read it shortly after October 7th because I felt like I needed to finally damn educate myself. And I recommend this book. There's other great books by Nora Erekat and many others, but Khalidi, who's a historian at Columbia, wrote this book, and it really traces the whole history of the birth of the state of Israel, which, contrary to what I had been told my whole life in Sunday school when I was bar mitzvahed, was actually a result of a massive land theft. So let's not kid ourselves. And that is why the state of Israel is really sort of consigned itself to perpetual conflict. Because you cannot create a nation by stealing another people's land and think you're going to live in peace. You know, and I will also say that what we're seeing now in Gaza is not just some weird byproduct of a war. This is not a war, folks. Okay. Gaza is not a state. Gaza has no army. Gaza has no air force. Gaza has no embassies. Okay. Gaza has no real government. Okay. This is a occupied territory illegally. And Israel is attacking it under the guise of trying to root out Hamas. I do not defend Hamas, but under the guise of trying to root out Hamas, they're using that, in my opinion, as cover to really slaughter civilians, decrease the population, make the area uninhabitable, with the hope of driving all Palestinians out of the territory into other countries. And, you know, that's not just my assessment, not just my opinion. I am not an expert on this. I'm just learning about this. But there's an article in 972 magazine, an Israeli publication by Abraham Yuval, who's a brilliant young journalist, that captures this out of a document produced by the intelligence ministry of the Netanyahu government on October 13th, less than 1 week after the Hamas attack of October 7th, where it outlines a plan to use this attack into Gaza as a pretext to drive and resettle all the Palestinians in the territory into Egypt. And folks, the famine, the denial of humanitarian aid, the incessant bombing, the complete destruction of cities, the using AI to determine targets, like collapsing entire apartment buildings, okay, with hundreds of people in them because there might be one junior Hamas fighter in the building. All of that has happened not by mistake, not because Israel is trying to take care to not harm civilians, but precisely because, in my opinion, the purpose of this so-called war is to destroy civilian life, make that area impossible to live in so people leave and Israel can colonize all of Gaza. And I will mention, as you know, that almost all people who live in Gaza actually come from what is known today as Israel. They had their land stolen. They're either refugees or descendants of refugees who should be living over the fence on the other side. Those are their villages, okay? So we have to understand the history. We have to understand the context. And I am indebted to Professor Khalidi for this book because it really helped me educate myself, but I'm hardly an expert. I'm just a pissed off Jew and a human rights lawyer right now.
Nice, that's a good combo, killer combo.
Yeah.
So last question for you is, as we celebrate Passover, you mentioned your Jewish values, how you find Israel's project antithetical to your Jewish values. What are your Jewish values? And what are the values that resonate with you as a Jew?
Thank you for asking that. You know, when I think of my Jewish values, and this is very personal, I mean, not only am I not an authority on Palestine, I'm not an authority on Judaism, even though I'm Jewish and I've had a bar mitzvah. Hardly qualifies me as like an intellectual authority of Judaism. But where I grew up in Northeast Florida, to Jewish parents. My mom always talked about the need to reach out and to care for others and to engage in civic life. My mom was a great example for me because when I was a kid, we would go to protests. We would, you know, my mom was hugely involved in the boycott in support of Cesar Chavez and the Farm Workers Union, for example. And of course, I read about Mississippi and you know, people would come down from the north to help with voter registration during the civil rights movement. And that, to me, is the best of Judaism. It really is. And there is no doubt Jews have been persecuted. There is no doubt there is real anti-Semitism. But I will say this. I don't feel like the so-called anti-Semitism talked about by certain members of Congress and members of the media on college campuses. I believe that there's a little bit of an element that some of that might be real. But there's a lot of that I believe is manufactured. And I think the Israeli government does it intentionally to give itself cover to kill Palestinians.
Well, Stephen, thank you so much for all your work and also for speaking with us. Love what you said.
Thank you for what you're doing. I love your work and, you know, keep the faith. Let's keep fighting.
Welcome, Susan Sarandon, Academy Award winning actor and activist. So excited to talk to you.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here. Exciting times.
Yes. So tell us why you've been out on the streets. You've been visiting encampments. Why is this issue about Palestine an important issue to you?
Well, for so many reasons. I mean, I've been following what's been going on in Palestine for many years, and that finally has gotten to the point where it's undeniable, which is the positive part of this onslaught and this genocide, is that suddenly the history is, the narrative is being challenged. The history is being known to more people of what happened before October 7th. And thanks to the advent of cell phones, we're actually, you know, for better or worse, seeing firsthand what a genocide looks to as it unfolds. And despite the fact that our government is refusing to in any way absorb the enormity of the situation, I think that real Americans, as you can tell from the polls, want a ceasefire. They can't stomach this, even if you're someone who isn't living online and is looking at statistics through mainstream media, which are, you know, definitely not on the side of Palestinians. Just the fact that we're giving so much money without any strings to a country that has health care, has subsidized housing, has free education, while we simultaneously with our tax money are knocking down all their institutions in Gaza, all the universities, wiping out culture, wiping out whole families. It's just gotten to the point now where it's undeniable. And the fact that so much of it is being done without a vote, and that we are continuing to allow illegal settlements. So we're in much deeper in this travesty than we are in other places, which are also deserving of examination. But the fact that it's so immediate in terms of, you know, our funding, that if we were to say cut off even for a few days, the whole thing would stop. It's very hard to just let it go. You can only deny for so long. And now with this amazing uptick of actions by kids that are so well versed in the history, that are, and we're seeing it, you know, Jewish kids, Muslim kids, just WASPy kids, everybody that is offended by this lack of humanity and who is not affiliated to a party, is not Democrat, is not Republican, but is just human, and says no to this kind of horrifying bullying by the United States, I think just has given me faith. That and unions are the only two things that I see going forward that really, really say, please stay in this country. You know, we can change the system. We can do something. And I was just, you know, I was up at Columbia. I was just now with the NYU kids, and they know what's going on. And they're, you know, they're embracing, they're praying together. It's just so beautiful to see what's possible. And to see them throwing off this yoke of censorship and discrimination and hatred and greediness and refusing to accept it. To me, this is just everything. So I'm so happy that I can go and say I stand with you. I mean, it's I can do very, very little as a as an individual, but when we're all together, then things start to happen, and we're seeing through the whole across the United States. And you know what happens is that, you know, Colombia made this mistake. They just overreacted. They could have just let it sit, and it would have gotten much less press. And now they've got the teachers quitting. I know that they have a niece at Barnard. I know that the kids that came to do the tours, because that's what's going on. So all these kids that were accepted at Columbia refused to do the tours, and they're sitting with the protesters. The kids that were hired to give the tours are refusing to give the tours. You know, it's gone all the way down, and it's so inspiring and so hopeful. You know, I'm really excited for the potential of what's going on now.
It seems like what you've observed is very different from what some of the media reports have been. Can you talk about that disconnect between what they're describing as kind of like scary, hateful protests versus what you're actually seeing and experiencing at these encampments?
Well, I think that the pro-Zionist narrative is being challenged in a very, very serious way. And so it's very important for the mouthpieces of power, which are the CNN, MSNBCs, New York Times, to do as much as they can to sell a narrative that is, you know, I was on, when I went to Columbia, they had my name, when they were reporting on it, they had my name, and then something about threatened students with a chainsaw, which then related to someone else in an article, but made it seem, if you're just looking at clickbait, that somehow I was raging with a chainsaw at Columbia. Now, that's a really extreme example, but you have just the passive and aggressive voices in the New York Times, which lots of studies have been done to show how many times the active voice was used to describe what was going on to Israelis. And this false narrative, which about how Jewish kids on campus are being terrified because they see protests, when you have students in Gaza or even students at Columbia who were sprayed and had to be hospitalized. And what's so horrifying about that is that the charge of anti-Semitism is real, and it shouldn't be leveled in some cases. And now it's just being thrown around so that it's losing its power, which is very dangerous. And I think the other thing that the news has done is to constantly reinforce this idea that all Zionists are Jewish, that all Jewish are Zionists. It's been very important and very difficult to change that narrative. I mean, I needed to really get my head on straight, and I was educated by all the Jewish protesters that are at these gatherings to make it very clear that every Jewish person, no matter if they had relatives in the Holocaust, whether or not they, you know, went through a Jewish upbringing, does not identify, does not claim to be a Zionist. And in fact, there's just as many, if not more, Christian Zionists.
Yeah, there are more.
That is not a religion. So that in itself has been reinforced by the media constantly. And when you hear, when the leaked memos come out that the BBC and all of these have said, you know, always say Hamas, do not say Palestinian, or do not say Gaza, always say war. Do, you know, anything they can do to make it seem like it's a justifiable war with a huge army that's in the same measure as the Zionist forces. And this reiteration of the only democracy there in the Middle East and all of these tropes that have been over and over and over again, and then ignoring or challenging these statistics are Hamas statistics. Don't trust those statistics, you know. This is all fake. This is staged. I think it's harder and harder to maintain those things. So what's happening now is they're coming at anybody who has a voice, who has the truth, who has facts. I mean, when I go to speak, I don't say anything except facts, because everything's so twisted or cut out in order to give the wrong impression. So at least if they're facts, they're facts. But even then, they say, oh, yeah, but those are Hamas facts, you know. So clearly, this has been aided and abetted by, and I'm sure there are journalists who want to get in and can't get in. CNN told us that they're watched when they come in. So we're so dependent on the journalists who are using their cell phones in Gaza, in the West Bank. But, you know, when people say to me, it's so complicated. I think really the thing that's complicated is knowing this and trying to stay neutral.
Very well said, Susan. And I want to thank you so much for joining us, but also for your fearless activism in spite of a lot of pushback that you've gotten. So we really appreciate that.
I just say that I'm afraid. It's not fearless, but I think sometimes if you don't, what you have to live with later is much more difficult.
Well, for your not fearless, but very courageous activism.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Thank you, Katie.
Bye, Susan.
Bye. Have fun at the Seder.
Thanks again for listening to The Katie Helper Show. If you like the show, please join the Patreon at patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. Please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. And as always, we remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. Our show is produced by me, Katie Helper. Brad Bloom is our audio engineer and an associate producer on the show. Our researcher is Joshua Bregman. And our theme song is by the band Cordova. See you next time.